security and survival in missions in the field. So, what could possibly go wrong on a mission? Well, some strange things have happened. First of all, expect delays. Expect potholes. You might have noticed in the river today that some places are deeper than others. And sometimes river crossings are just like flooded. And sometimes freeways are too. You can see that the drainage doesn't seem to be up to par. This is what happens when people litter with plastic. And plastic gets into the drainage as storage, storm drains, and the municipality doesn't clean up before the rainy season comes. But innovation is the way to go. You know, you just have to admire this person. The way how he manages to use his bicycle and balance. I mean, that is balance. That's innovation. Make things happen. Yeah. This is a Kawasaki. Yeah, no, I've seen some strange things on the road. And sometimes you see some overloading in Africa and India. And, yep, this vehicle is tired. And how much is too much? How many can you fit on? More. And, you know, you wonder how they fit through some of the bridges and things like that. But this vehicle will not last that long if you treat like that. And yes, we have had to cross bridges like this. This is a specific bridge up in Western Zambia. Expect wildlife on the road. And the first law of the road in Africa is elephants have right of way. And by the way, it's their area. So, you know, if the elephant wants to come to your campsite, just be friendly. And remember, second rule of the road, never cross a solid yellow line in the road. Never cross a solid yellow line in the road. Lions have right of way. Don't hoot. And if you have not experienced a lion in the wild, not in a vehicle where you're behind metal, but out there, you will know what fear and respect and awe is of God's creation. By the way, when you hear a knock at the door, you shouldn't always open it. Now, when it comes to scorpions, yes, we get stung by scorpions. The big clippers, it's like a bee sting, nothing serious. These guys, big pincers, thin tail, pinprick, bit of itching. This, the light, whitish, almost transparent ones, this is life-threatening. They've got a thick tail, that's where the poison is, thin clippers. I've been stung by one of these in Vietnam. Let me tell you, that gets you praying. Expect bad roads. And this is a Shosheki road. And yes, these roads are rough on some of our tires. And we have had to dig out our vehicles, who knows how much. And this is not unusual. This is the main road in Sudan. This is one of the bridges in Sudan. This is why we have to make sure our literature doesn't get wet. We pack our Bibles in plastic, we put them in waterproof containers, we duct tape the containers, and before river crossings, you've got to double check because the bad roads would have shaken things loose and you'd have to reseal before every river crossing. And one of us would walk in front. I would frequently be in front with a hiking stick testing. You don't want a big rock to rip the sump out of your vehicle. You want to walk through, work out the best way, and then guide the vehicle through the river, and they've got to come fast. Because you dare not stall your engine underwater. Because if the exhaust pipe is underwater, you can't restart the car without seizing the engine. So you cannot allow the engine to seize or stop. You can't. After that, what are you going to do? Because your battery is probably not going to be able to winch the vehicle out easily without the engine running. Anyway, so yes, we had a winch on there. But again, that's got to be ready. Normally, it should be dangled at the top. We were quite confident crossing this particular part of the Yei River. Still, interesting to show you that new is not necessarily progress. We have had it on good authority from the Dr. Comes to Louis book, which we've got here, that back in 1920s, you could travel faster on these roads on a bicycle than you can with a four-wheel drive now. The time it would take them with messengers going by bicycle between the different roads, because the road was so much better, the same distances in South Sudan, they could do faster on a bicycle in the 1920s and 1930s than we can do in a four-wheel drive today. How's that for progress? Expect challenges. And there's all kinds of challenges that can occur in the field. Of course, weather, storms. And, well, this is the first time I approached the Sudan border from, and this is when it was still Sudan, before South Sudan had its independence. And that was the border post between Kenya and eastern Equatoria. And one of the first things that challenges your prayer life is when you see thick-skinned vehicles, I mean tanks, armored cars, shot out, destroyed, immobilized. It improves your prayer life because here we came across 12 shot out vehicles in the space of 1 kilometer. Now, if hard-skinned military vehicles didn't make it, what's the chance of our soft-skinned bucky making it when the tanks didn't make it? This is ambush alley. This is where vehicles get ambushed. There's landmines, ambushes, all sorts of things. On this occasion, I mentioned to you a few days ago about how what you should not do when you're traveling in a war-torn area is have the windows up and the air conditioning on and the music on or something like this, or listening to a tape deck, because you have to hear what's going on. And so windows down, listening, because in fact the vehicle never heard the jets coming. The MiG bombed out vehicle, and the first anyone knew about it was this big explosion. The vehicle went careening off the road by the blast, and that was where the bomb landed. And these jets can come up on you very fast, but you want to hear it. They didn't miss with this vehicle. Expect illness, like tick bite fever, malaria, all that sort of thing. Expect opposition. Believe it or not, there are people who disagree with what we are saying. And yes, there's radical Islamization. There's some terrorist groups like Boko Haram in Nigeria. And just in case you couldn't understand Arabic, they very kindly put it in English too, that you can understand. I think there's the Quranic Bible study, Quranic study group or something like that. At any rate, you can see they've got different forms of outreach to what we do. Expect persecution. We've come under fire, rocket fire, artillery fire, aerial bombardments, churches we've ministered and been bombed. In fact, I could say easily, in 1,200 church services, school meetings, Bible studies, chapel services I've conducted inside Sudan, I think every single school, every single church, every single hospital I've ever ministered in had been bombed at least once, sometimes 10 times. One place had been bombed 18 times in the previous 12 months. And so aerial bombardments happen. So how do we respond? How can we minimize our chance of being a casualty? Well, the first thing is you want to know that you're right with the Lord. You want to know you're called. And sometimes the bombs fail to explode. This probably wasn't very intelligent, getting a picture taken by an unexploded bomb. In fact, this bomb hadn't exploded, and the espionage had dug it out. And so it had buried itself in the ground. They dug it out and brought it up, and then I got a picture. And to kind of document what the Arabs were doing, but still, unexploded bombs are not the sort of thing you want to play with. If this had gone off, it would have taken the church and the compound where we were ministering off the map. This is at Yay. Nib Mountains. You can get imprisoned. Happened to me in Lusaka Central Prison, Zambia, 1987. I've spoken about that at length. We don't know what the story is for this vehicle, but you can see it's in South Sudan, got shot up. You can see the bullet holes around, and mines, of course. There's lots of mines. The chapter in Psalms that I read just when we were being arrested in Kazungulu Ferry, Zambia, 1987, was, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evil men advance against me to devour my flesh, when my enemies and my foes attack me, they will stumble and fall. Though an army besiege me, my heart will not fear. Though war breaks out against me, even then I will be confident." Now, we've got to ask ourselves, what am I forgetting? Sometimes we can do some pretty strange things, like forgetting our handbag and groceries on top of the car. Where did I put my handbag? And maybe it would have been better to reverse into the river when you've got a boat. We've got to think ahead. Now, I don't know what's going to happen to the chap behind when the motorbike in front stops. You see some very strange things on the road. And duct tape can solve a lot of problems. When you don't know how to hold things together, duct tape is a solution. This was the first trip with the very trailer you see outside. And this picture shown, taken back to the people advertised. This is for the toughest roads in Africa and so on. On its first trip, well, Sudan's roads are worse than most, I suppose. But still, this was a challenge. And these are the kind of mechanical challenges you can face in the field that needs welding and fixing. Now, the Bible records and warns of many crisis situations, natural disasters, and man-made threats. Floods, famines, fires, earthquakes, epidemics, plagues, persecution, riots, theft, and wars. What makes us think that we will be exempt from any of these things? It's been part of history, it's part of life, it's even the Bible. The flood. Have you noticed? Well, when God brought down fire and brimstone on Sodom and Gomorrah, he sent angels to rescue his people. God warned Joseph that there was going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. He used the 7 years of plenty to prepare for the 7 years of famine. And he not only saved Egypt, but he saved his people from Israel who came there for deliverance and for food. God has delivered his people from the Egyptians. Think of the walls of Jericho coming down. You can think of Samaria being besieged by the Assyrians and destroyed, and Jerusalem being destroyed twice, first by Nebuchadnezzar, later by the Emperor Titus, the Roman Empire. And so the fact that God could withdraw his protection from Israel, from the temple itself in Jerusalem, because of their idolatry and because of their faithlessness to God, should show us nobody gets a blank check from God. We must listen to the warnings. There are many warnings in the Bible. Christians in the early centuries endured a lot of persecution. Psalm 46, which inspired a mighty fortress of God, declares, God is our refuge and strength and ever-present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though the waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. So these are some biblical principles for preparedness. Proverbs 22, verse 3. The prudent see danger and take refuge, but the simple keep going and suffer for it. Foresight, foreknowledge, forewarning is very helpful. We should be considerate and consider what do we do if. And so a good team leader has got plan A, B, C, D. Because things don't always go according to plan. In fact, it's an axiom in the military that no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. The moment you contact the enemy, he reacts, and then your plan can sort of go to hell in a handbasket. Just think of chess. You may have your plan, but the other side, he has a reaction. So just the fact that you've got your moves planned out, he may not cooperate with what you want, and so it is in almost anything. Proverbs 3, verse 25 to 26 says, have no fear of sudden disaster or of the ruin that overtakes the wicked, for the Lord will be your confidence. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. Now you see the balance here. We should anticipate problems and make provision. But we shouldn't live in fear. God hasn't given us a spirit of fear. But then we should learn from nature. Sometimes you get times. In fact, when you've got summer, you should be storing up and preparing for winter. When you have summer, you should be preparing to make sure you don't have leaks when the rain comes, and so on and so forth. It was not raining when Noah built the ark. That is the ultimate example of preparedness. Noah was preparing long before the rain came, and so we need to be prepared. We need to be prepared for bad days, bad seasons. These things happen. Christians are to wisely anticipate danger, and we're to make provision for times of scarcity. We're not to fear the future, we're to fear God alone. But we are warned to plan for the future and to prepare ourselves for adversity. Man is born to trouble as surely as the sparks fly upward. If you falter in times of trouble, how small is your strength? We must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God. Now this in Acts 14 verse 22 is very interesting verse. It says that Paul and Barnabas encouraged the believers. How did they encourage them? By telling them, we must pass through much tribulation to enter the kingdom of heaven. And this encouraged them. They would have thought, if they tried that these days, what would they get? Get thee behind me, Satan. I don't receive that. I have the power of life and death in my tongue. And so you'll get many people who don't want to take warning. And yet, we read in the book of Acts that it encouraged the believers to hear, we must pass through much tribulation to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, Lord Jesus suffered for us and left us an example that we should follow in his footsteps. Why should I expect a bed of roses? Why should I expect to be wrapped up in cotton wool and bubble wrap and raptured to heaven and avoid all my responsibilities and challenges on earth? It's a privilege to suffer for Christ. And so, surely, it's not something we should avoid and say, oh, I only want the comfortable, easier signs. What's wrong with us if we only want the easier signs? It's a privilege to be given a tougher sign by God. We are hard-pressed on every side, but we're not crushed. We're perplexed, but we're not in despair. We're persecuted, but not abandoned. We're struck down, but we're not destroyed. Now, practical principles for protection. There's mental preparation, there's emotional preparation, there's spiritual preparation. Before you get to the practical, it's more important to have the mental, emotional, and spiritual preparedness. I've learned the secret of being content in each and every situation. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Philippians 4, 12 to 13. Now, there are people who've had the best of everything and have given up. There's one example of a U.S. Air Force jet pilot. Do you know how much selection training they go through to fly these multi-million dollar aircraft? And something went wrong on his test flight. He's up near Alaska over pretty icy waters, and he had to eject, ditch his plane. Well, it wasn't that bad. He got the Mayday out. He had a life preserver vest on, and which he could blow up. He had a satellite GPS tracking device that was homing in the aid. And in fact, Coast Guard was only about 20 minutes away. By the time they got there, I mean, okay, the water's icy, freezing cold. But the man shot himself with his service pistol before they got to him. Now, it was a bad situation, you would think, but it wasn't that bad. It's not like he had to spend days in the water. He was just having to wait about 25 minutes. And he couldn't even wait 5 minutes. He shot himself about 20 minutes before help came. And that just shows that it doesn't matter all the great equipment you've got. At the end of the day, it's the mental, emotional, and spiritual. When I was imprisoned in Lusaka Central Prison back in 1970, we had a team of four. And three of the team did very well, and one of the team did extremely badly. Very badly, embarrassingly badly. And he basically cracked up. And that's a problem. Not everyone responds the same. And that individual, in fact, he had military background. He had good training. There was no reason for him to crack up as far as I'm concerned. Yet we had a civilian who had no military background on our team who came through it fine. He had the right attitude. So it's not only training, it's often just attitude that makes a difference. I've seen people go into the same situation and surprise you by the ones who come through with shining colors and the ones who give up. The will to win, determination, resilience, the fighting spirit is basic to survival. You have to have the will to survive. Romans 8, 35 to 37 says, trouble, shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword, shall any of these separate us from the love of God? No. In all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. So we are commanded, be on your guard, stand firm in the faith, be men of courage, be strong. It's a command to be strong, and I think this has often been forgotten. We've got a lot of wimps, wets, weeds, and those who are absolutely paranoid and panic-stricken, who want to get the fact that so many people have fallen for the pandemic panic, and the lockdown lunacy so that we can't do outreaches because we might get the virus. Honestly and truly, Christians ministered through the plague. Zwingli ministered during the plague. Luther welcomed people into his house while his wife was pregnant during the plague. Turned his home into a hospital for people suffering from the bubonic plague, which is very, very contagious. Vastly more deadly than any coronavirus. They didn't give up the ministry. We don't stop because we get malaria, tick bite fever, hepatitis, or anything else. And so in the field, we come across many challenges. Yes, it's often hard. It's difficult. It's a challenge. We get wet. We get cold. We might get arrested. We go through some horrific situations. But the obstacles are only there to be overcome. We can get across the rivers. We can get... Crocodiles should not stop us crossing rivers. And swamps should not stop us getting the Bibles in. And first of all, we need a security assessment. So first of all, determine the level of the threat. You need to gain a general knowledge of your region's history and the culture and build up relationships with local people. Ask these questions, the 5 W's and H. Who, why, what, where, when, and how. 5 W's and H. That'll answer most questions at any time. Who might wish to mount an attack against the mission? Why? Maybe for robbery, retaliation, right, ransom, faction or tribal fighting. We've gotten caught up before in faction fighting without knowing it. But because we're helping one particular tribe, we thought we're helping the people of the country. Meanwhile, others saw you helping that tribe. You're not helping my tribe. Well, we didn't even know there was a tribal problem. And next thing you know, you are guilty because you've helped these people. And how did we know that the other ones consider help of one tribe to be somehow an attack on another tribe? Who would have guessed that? Those things can happen. What are the likely targets? Your supplies, your vehicles, your personnel. We've had vehicles stolen. How might an attack be carried out? Ambush, armed robbery, hostage taking? Where are you most vulnerable? Actually, we're most vulnerable when we travel. Traveling is always the most dangerous thing we do, especially on the road. By the way, do you know what form of transport is the most dangerous form of transport? Percentage of the distance traveled and so on. Trains. Trains are actually statistically a high percentage of people die on the distances traveled by trains in the air or in the cars. And of course, you're far safer in the air than you are in cars. So cars are definitely much, 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 much more dangerous than flying an aircraft. Because while not much may go wrong in aircraft most of the time, when something does happen, it's bad, but it's not that often. Whereas car accidents are much more common. But train accidents, when a train accident happens, it's big. It's bad. So when you travel, you're most vulnerable. And when are you most vulnerable? Probably traveling at night. So determine your strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. That's called the SWOT analysis. SWOT. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. We should do this regularly for ourselves, for our mission, for our team. Be aware of threat indicators. Threat indicators are cold or harsh stares from the military or local population or hostile graffiti. You know, if you suddenly have something like death to all missionaries written on the side of the wall, that might be considered a threat indicator. Remember going into Boer Kop and seeing death to America, death to Israel. That was in 2001. And, you know, one Jew, one bullet. And you kind of got the impression, okay, we can see where they stand on this. And that was around 9/11. You saw Viva Bin Laden written on some wall. So you get a bit of a feel that there's somebody in the community there who is trying to push at that kind of mentality. But when you start getting something directed against your mission or your church, you should pay attention. Exterior decorating by Gorbachev and Sons. This is in Angola, one of our teams. And you can see the bullet holes in the walls. RPG went through there and all that. So in the field, often just having to camp out, we would have a ground sheet that would often be to keep the dew off you. And this is often just home in the field. Most security incidents happen while you're traveling. Always know exactly where you're going and plan accordingly. Because a lot of problems happen when people take the wrong road and they double back. And, you know, doubling back in a field where there might be mines around the road and so on, and you've got to turn off the road and go around on a single track, you're increasing your dangers too. But the thing is, getting lost, having to ask for directions, taking the wrong turn, a lot of bad things happening taking the wrong turn. Radiate confidence, but be discreet and unassuming. Don't be provocative. The last thing you need is to act like an American actor in some of these movies where they just, you know, you're not going to get anywhere with having an aggressive attitude. And I've seen where that gets some people. You've got to be, you know, a soft answer turns away wrath. But a harsh answer can stir up wrath. So it's important to be unprovocative. Even if they've been provocative, unreasonable, irrational, we just be more calm, more logical. Maintain a calm, mature approach to all circumstances. Be alert to the possibility of confrontation with individuals or groups. We should anticipate. Could this be a threat? This situation, that person. Obviously, the best thing is to avoid confrontations in the field. Keep valuables out of sight. The amount of people who've lost things because they've put their bag out there in the back seat of the car. Oh, one of the less intelligent things is after telling our people the importance of having something like a money belt or something where you keep your documents, your passport and so on. One of our chaps had it, but it was hot. So he took it off and he put it on the dashboard of his car. So there's this spread all money, passports, everything valuable, right out in the front dashboard. Windows down because it's hot. And Cairo Road, Lusaka, someone's hand just came in, gone. And another one of our people, she's actually my secretary, and was on a field trip there, and her handbag was stolen. There was everything in the handbag, passports and everything else. And so one of our people went running after this chap and ran. It just shows why it's important to be able to do running, because he ran virtually the length of Cairo Road in Lusaka. But he tracked it, and as he was gaining on his trap, the man just threw the handbag down and kept running. So he could escape, but we retrieved everything and lost nothing. When that was quick, and the fact that he could run and keep running until a chap in front was losing endurance, and he knew, I'm going to get caught, but I just give this up. And that solved the problem. Make several copies of your passport and driver's license, identity documents, air tickets, whatever is important. File a copy at head office that we can send through electronically if you need. Carry spares in your different parts of your luggage. Some people say, oh, well, I've got it all on my phone. Well, what if your phone's stolen? It's fine to have a copy on your phone, but have backups. And always carry your original documents on your person. Even when I go in the shower, whatever that may be, it might be balancing on some rocks or some logs behind some ferns and using a cup of water out of a bucket. But I will have my documents and everything else with me. You don't want to lose those things. If you're traveling on trains or taxis or buses, discuss and decide beforehand what the cost is. Because if you just get in, take me to such and such, the movies, they never ask what it costs. Well, then they can charge you anything when you get the other side. Like 10 times, 20 times what it actually is. So always ask beforehand. If it's unreasonable, then you don't get a taxi and they'll bring the price down. I mean, you must negotiate and agree on how much to go to airport, consul, this church, whatever it is. And it's also useful to have the address of your destination written out in local language. Like if you're not familiar in Arabic, for example, you might want to have it written down in Arabic so that you could show them they know exactly where to go. Because most of us probably aren't very good at chicken scratch. Sorry, Arabic. To be able to find your way there. Don't accept sweets or food from strangers. It could be a sedative and you could wake up hours later and find all your belongings gone. One of the classics, this is actually related to Lonely Planet about Sudan, that some travelers doing an Africa overland. They had their Land Rover and all this and they get to Sudan and they heard that crime's very bad in Sudan. So they decide to sleep inside their vehicle, and they just left a very small gap in the window. Next morning, they woke up, the sun was high up, and it was, they felt drugged, and their heads felt thick, and they lost all their clothes were gone, all their backpacks were gone, everything's gone. Some of the tires were gone, too. And they'd pump gas into the vehicle, put them out, sleeping gas, and then they'd just come and take everything around them. They'd even taken clothes off that they were wearing while they were sleeping. And they were left no shoes, boots, and so on, not enough tires on the car to drive. Anyway, this is a lonely planet, just speaking about understanding different countries as you travel. You don't want to get drugged. And the easiest thing is for some nice, friendly person to offer you something to drink or eat, and then they can rob you blind. Or you might wake up in some Saudi Arabian human trafficking den or whatever. In any hostel or hotel or guest house, always secure the doors when you're inside your room. Using the locks and security chains or bolts if they've got them. If not available, use a chair or heavy suitcase, something, but you can't just depend on a key. I've been in Nigeria in a hotel and had prostitutes come into the door, given a key, you know, these sort of, what do you call keys, card keys, by reception, coming in there. Like, what? Fortunately, I had the chains, I had the chair by the door, so somebody trying to get in, and they had the card from reception. Nobody's heard that there's a foreigner. I'm not interested. You're a disease factor. Go away. And you know, insane. There's not enough money on the planet for you to pay me to be willing. So forget about it. Go get lost. And this happened in Hungary as well. I had a couple of these prostitutes nail me down, trying. I had to literally physically push them off. They were just lit that aggressive. And you get people all over the place who are after you. So you got to be careful. Now, notice when you're in any place, in case of a fire emergency, what is the exit? Do you know the exit? And if you're in a place like Nigeria, they have chained the exit routes. The emergency exits, they've got a chain and padlock, and there's no key behind glass for security. So if there is a fire, you can't get out through the fire doors and exit things. And the burglar, windows are burglar barred. Even when you go onto the verandas, the verandas burglar. How are you going to get out in the event of a fire? And, many of these places that have place for the fire extinguisher, but the fire extinguisher is not there, or the fire extinguisher is flat, or the hose pipe has been stolen, there's a tap there, but there's no hose pipe, or the fire exit is gone from where the fire exit is going to be, for opening doors. So, you know, how are you going to get in the event of a fire? And you're trapped because of security concerns. They do this in many schools too, chaining. Emergency fire exits. There's a lot of nonsense. If you've got to get out, what's your way out? Do you know the way out? And it's, normally you're in a trap in most of these hotels and places like Nigeria and so on. Be alert to the possibility of being followed to Europe. Or as I found in Hungary and in Nigeria, reception will call up the prostitutes, drug dealers, whatever, and tell them we've got a new person up there and they'll come to your room, they'll have your name and everything. And they'll just be able to let themselves in because reception gives them. They might be bribed to do so, but the fact is there's no security as far as the hotel goes. So, what do you do if you're caught in crossfire? If you hear gunfire while you're on foot, immediately take cover on the ground. Lie flat, face down. Stay calm, don't panic, don't run. If possible, improve your protection by crawling to a ditch or a hole or behind a wall or inside a building. For example, in any house, probably the safest place to be would be in the hallway, because it's got double walls, or in a bathroom, in the bath maybe, because that's also got some solid walls. Know where the solid walls are in your house. If you're in a place like America where everything's made of compressed sawdust and plywood, a bullet could go through 15 houses before it stops in some poor soul who's in the way, because these things are paper thin, so they've got to make special bullets that'll not go through walls there, because the walls are so thin. That's why I remember the first time seeing in a film somebody punching a man through the wall, and I thought, that's ridiculous. You can't punch a person through a wall. Well, not in South Africa, you can't, because we've got brick walls. But over there, you could do it. You could get so angry, you put your fist through the whole wall. Even if the wall looks like rock, it's probably fake. So, you know. But you must know, where is there something solid that you can hide behind? If you're caught in crossfire and you hear gunfire when you're in a building, keep clear of windows and doors. Why? Glass splinters and flies around. And wooden doors, they also splinter. And bits of splinter flying around. That's one of the first things that alerted Shaw to the fact that St. James was under real attack and not some student skit, was when he saw splinters flying from the pews in St. James Church that 25th of July, 1993. So don't be too close to doors and windows because glass is going to fly and wood can splinter too. Take shelter in the best protected areas like the bathroom, the basement, under a stairwell, behind a solid wall. If you hear gunfire when you're in a vehicle, reverse. And do you know how to, you should practice reversing in a parking lot when there's no other cars there. And see how fast you can reverse and do a handbrake U-turn, things like that. Try not to do it when you've got a trailer on first because you want to first handle a bucky. Handling a trailer with a reverse is very hard. You can jackknife easily. Try to avoid sidetracks and verges, which could easily be mined. And in an attack, especially an air attack or an ambush, never take shelter under a vehicle. Why would you not take shelter under a vehicle? Yes, if there's bullets or shrapnel, it can pierce the tank. If you're hiding under the vehicle, maybe some of the oil can drip on you and you can become flammable. So not a good idea. Vehicles are targets. We used to call them bullet magnets. And so you want to get away from the vehicle.
What about behind the vehicle or behind an open door of the vehicle?
Oh, well, that's fine. If you're talking about an ambush, that you try to put as much metal of the vehicle between you and the attack, that makes sense. But if it's an air attack, the vehicle is the target. So yes, that's a different thing. So if, for example, you're in the driver's side of a car and there's suddenly a blockage across the road and maybe you're blocked behind and you can't reverse out because reversing out would be the way you could go around, but you can't. And they're firing from this side. You need to practice. You should do this, that you can get your seatbelt off, put your feet against the door and push yourself out the back seat there. So to get out the other side. You're not going to get out the same side, but can you, lying flat, open the door and go and literally propel yourself through the passenger side out onto the ground, keeping as much of the car between you and the attack. So that's a practice drill we've done here on the front lawn too, that everyone is in that if you're attacked on the driver's side, can you get out the other side? Obviously, you should use your vehicle as a weapon if you can. Somebody standing in the road trying to shoot at you, go straight for them, accelerate, because you can't aim and shoot and avoid being ridden over at the same time. So if you're the target of an ambush while driving in a vehicle, accelerate, use the vehicle as a defensive weapon. Attempt to get out of the killing area as quickly as possible. Obviously, if they've chosen an ambush site, they want you to stay there. Maybe there's a branch across the tree or across the road or something like that. But I've had it before, back in 1993, when this country was going insane. I was invited to Siskai to run a biblical worldview seminar there. And coming around a mountain pass, coming down into Siskai, and as I reached the intersection, there's a huge mob of people. And then I saw they had all the way across the road, pulled drums and tires and things like this. But fortunately, I could see there's a bit of solid surface to the side of the road, and I accelerated around them, and I gunned through the other side of the intersection. I couldn't go back up the pass because there's a winded pass you could more easily fall off. So reversing was an option. I had to go through, spun past, and saw at the other end of the intersection, they were still, they built a barricade as well. I went hurtling towards that, and as we reached it, I said, Charles, move that drum. Charles bounced out of the passenger seat, ran out there, rolled the drum away. Someone was running towards him. He aimed at 38. They stopped. He got back in the car, and at this point, believe it or not, one American woman who's with us from Texas had gotten out of the car to try and explain to them, but we're missionaries, and we're here to help you, and so on. And these people are running. One person's got this hulking great big rock. He's running with this rock, either to throw in front of the vehicle or to throw through our windscreen. And I shouted, Martha, get back in the car. And she says, no, but I'm just... And Charles gave an even harsher demand. and yanked her back into the car, and we hurtled off as I heard thump, thump, and things hitting our car. We went through this gap that we'd made. Now, the point is we had seconds to get through there. And it was done all much faster than it takes me to explain it. But we could have become statistics, or worse still, we could have started a biblical worldview seminar with missionary shoots, so many writers, you know. None of it would have been good. It would have been a bad scenario and bad PR. Well, we were on our way to Bishu, so we had just we were just coming in from the East London side. And so it was before Bishu coming down the pass, so I could take one right to it. Unreal. When I told Brigadier Gorzel what had happened, he quickly sent a whole lot of people to sort out what was going on there. But it was an insane time. I mean, this sort of thing was going almost anywhere. And they would drag people out of cars, and like Amy Beale got, what, 70-something stab wounds, driving somebody from UCT back to Langa one night. And Amy Beale was a commie. I mean, she is a hardcore pro-abortion commie. And she's trying to explain, but I'm on your side. I'm here to help you. And they didn't care. She is white. She's American. I mean, what more do you need? And so here Amy Beale was such a communist. And so she is here to help them legalize abortions. Her parents came and hugged and kissed the murderers. I mean, that's the kind of parents they've got. Totally insane people. They started the Amy Beale Foundation to fund the very people who murdered her. You know, but that was the time that this happened. Same time they were ripping apart Americans who were here specifically to help the commies. So, insane. The main thing is you've got to get out of a killing area as quickly as possible. This is where they've chosen to have the ambush. You don't want to park where they've made the killing zone. If you're caught in the midst of shelling or bombing, aerial bombardment, artillery shelling, take cover immediately on the ground, lie flat, face down. Now, the reason for this is a bomb will go in and it'll explode up and outwards. Now, in the dirt areas where we tend to be in Sudan, the bomb will bury quite far into the dirt, as you saw with that picture where our vehicle was bombed. Fortunately, it'll go quite far into the sand or mud before exploding, and therefore the blast pattern's more like that. So if you're lying flat, even right next to where it happened, you will survive. Whereas if you're standing up, maybe even 50 or 100 meters away, you could get hit by shrapnel. So running away from a bombing is insane. And the sort of thing they do in Mission Impossible, trying to outrun explosions and outdive explosions. And even in a tunnel, you can have an explosion tunnel and they still manage to outrun the explosion. That can only happen in a Mission Impossible movie because there's no way that anyone can outrun an explosion. But you can lie flat. And I've survived a 1,000-kilogram bomb exploding 17 meters from me just by lying flat. And the shrapnel was all over the place. I mean, we were finding shrapnel 100 meters the other side of the church. And if we'd been standing up, we could have been shredded. Lying flat is your best chance of survival from a bomb blast. But protect your eardrums. The funny thing is, what came to my mind when I was being bombed in Sudan was what my mother said during the bombings. And she had endured something like 60 aerial bombardments in Berlin, in Germany, during the war. As a little girl, age 6, she experienced the first bombing. And she knew, protect your eardrums, cover your ears with your hands, and open your mouth. Why? You've got to equalize the pressure. If your mouth is closed, your ears can burst. Burst ears are extremely painful. So when you're getting a bombing, the first thing you want to do is open your mouth slightly and close. If you can cover your ears, you cover your ears. Because the explosion, the shockwave, it can burst your eardrums. It's very bad. So balance the pressure of the blast. If possible, improve your protection from shrapnel by taking cover in a ditch, trench hole, or on the ground floor of a building with solid concrete walls. Never take cover under a vehicle in a bombing. So, you can see one of the unexploded bombs around a mission station in Sudan. Some of the shrapnel that landed around us, this is one of the bomb landed right to the side over there, and this is shrapnel that we've got. We've got some of the shrapnel here, even that I'm showing there. That piece there is right in the display cabinet over there. And these are other pieces of shrapnel that hang around there. You can see one of the big pieces of shrapnel outside by our eating area outside. If a grenade rolls towards you, kick it away, turn the opposite direction, take a giant leap and lie down. Drop down and face down with your feet the closest to the target, keeping your hands to your side and keeping the soles of your feet close together, because presumably the boots or soles of your feet, and in the field I'm always wearing boots, can better absorb the shrapnel if there's any going to come. But you want to be as small a target as possible. You don't want your head or your upper body to be the target, and the soles of your boots might well be able to handle, maybe it'll have a piece of shrapnel buried in, but shrapnel flying from grenades, again, if it's on the ground, it's going to go up and out more. So the lower you are, the better chance of surviving. Don't keep running. You know, these people are running in bombings. Just take the Pearl Harbor movie, which is actually a love story disguised as a war film. Very impossible, unrealistic. You can't have hordes of people running on a tarmac with machine guns all around them and escaping. It's impossible. Because on hard surfaces, if it's not dirt, the bullets are going to splash. They'll fragment and they're going to go in all directions. You can't run on concrete on a tarmac while they're machine gunning without expecting some of that to hit you. Because there's massive splash that's coming all over the place. But some of the movies, they can run through hails of bullets on tar surface without being hit by anything. That's not possible. And of course, the dumbest thing you can do is, if they're coming to take you this way, why run that way? You're running into the kill zone. If you turn around, you ran towards the plane would overshoot you quicker. You're less likely. They can't exactly shoot backwards. So if you are being attacked by a plane, the best thing would be not to keep running. And you know, it's like sword. Don't go where the sword's going. Go where the sword's been. And so if you had to run, rather run towards a plane than run away from it. It just makes sense if you understand the way it works. The blast range for a grenade can be up to 30 meters in all directions. You're far less likely to sustain injury if you're lying face down on the ground than if you're standing upright. Grenade fuses vary from 4 to 8 seconds. A well-trained special forces type would pull a pin, count for 2 seconds and then throw it to not give you much chance to. But most people, most inferior, got to pull a pin, immediately throw it, because nobody wants to have a live ticking grenade in their hand. So you've normally got a few seconds between them throwing it and it exploding. So when in a war zone, well, one of the questions that we've got to ask our people continually is, are you willing to lose everything you're taking into the field? Don't take anything in the field that you're not willing to lose, and that includes your own life. If you're not willing to die for Christ, don't go into a war zone or restricted access area or to the persecuted church, because honestly, that is a worst case scenario of what can happen. And so as a Christian, we've got to be absolutely assured of our salvation and sure of our calling and sure that we're right with God. And if it's God's will, now I'm convinced you are safer in the middle of a battle in the will of God than in bed at home out of the will of God. I'm convinced the safest place in the world is in the center of God's will. But let's face it, there have been some people in God's providence who have died young. There's some people who have died in God's service. There's some people who have died in mission fields. It has happened. But I've got to know that if it does, it's in God's hands and I'm not to worry about it. What I'm more concerned about is my dedication to the Lord and my faithfulness to His word. But if you were to die today, where would you spend eternity? I mean, that's a good question to ask. I've had to ask teams many a time before going into the Nuba Mountains of Sand. Do not take anything into the field you're not willing to lose, including your own life. And if you have any hesitation that, don't come. And that's an important thing to go through. Landmines. Any geographic area that's experienced fighting and where there's warring parties and have strong defensive positions will be mined. It's a way of denying areas to the enemy. Now, if they fear, they will have signs out warning minefields, like the British and Germans did in North Africa. They actually fenced off and had warning signs, minefield, to prevent people coming into that area so that they didn't have to patrol as much, especially in desert, that made sense. But the commies don't work like that. They plant mines without posting their sign telling you there's mines there. That's very neat. This is particularly true of lowlands in front of a defensive hill, or position, or military places, or strategic building, or bridge. And any approaches, bridges, railways, airstrips, intersections, water sources, wells, pumps, depressions, ditches near town. In the Nuba Mountains, they were planting mines on paths, especially to water pumps and wells, and to the river, and to church, and to the marketplace. This was just a means of terror. And which is why we took my mine-clearing equipment, mine-detecting equipment that I bought in Germany, brought back to South Africa, and we took in mine-clearing equipment up to the Nuba Mountains of Sudan to help them to clear these areas. The two main classes of landmines is anti-vehicle and is anti-personnel. That's us, we personnel. Now, anti-vehicle mines are normally designed to explode when a weight in excess of 100 kilograms triggers it. They are often fitted with devices to kill or wound a person trying to lift or neutralize them. This is a typical anti-vehicle mine or even anti-tank mine. This is the kind of horrible little anti-personnel mine they've got. Anti-personnel mines only require 3 kilograms of pressure and fall into two main categories. The first relies on a blast meant to blow off a foot or leg. They generally design these anti-personnel mines not to kill you, but to cripple you. They just want to blow off a foot. They've worked out it takes less explosive, and also it does more harm to a rebel movement to have an injured person than to have a dead person, because injured person, more people are taken out of the situation, have to get them to medical care. And so there's an actual policy that anti-personnel mines are not designed to kill, they're primarily designed to injure, because they believe that that's going to actually harm the economy more over time. And the second type throws a container into the area where it bursts and scatters shrapnel to wound or maim anyone within effective range. So the POMS mine, for example, would be click. You've armed it. And when you hear the click, you should stay put. And then an engineer should come and you should put metal things under there to kind of hold the weight, put weights inside that you can take your foot off and all the weights along. Because the click arms it. The moment you take pressure off, things going to have a primary detonation, shoot up a mine to about chest height, and then the secondary explosion, sideways, take out a whole lot of people. So I've known people who survived that. They've stepped on, click. Don't move. Call for help. Others, like, put a knife in, put weight on the side so that you can take his weight off and the weights remain depression and, get out the area. But then, to get to him, it's normally been slow because if there's one, there might be more. So to approach, come in using knives, bayonets at angles to feel if there's any other mines, and they had to clear other mines around before they could get away to him, and then follow the track back exactly as it came in, because in a minefield, now you're not sure what the extent is, because these people aren't fair. Unlike Second World War in North Africa, they don't put a fence around and sign. So, but you can survive this if you walk in, you hear click. That should not happen. You shouldn't. What was that? Because then it shoots up and then sideways. So the POMS grenades are absolutely horrible. The other thing is, I've walked in the field and felt wire. You look down, there's a wire, and wires don't occur in nature naturally. Although evolutionists might think that over billions of years it might have evolved, but it doesn't. So what they've got is a stake with a pineapple-looking grenade on the top of it, and then it's got a thin wire stretched to maybe a branch or tree on the other side on a path. And as you go through and you break the wire, it pulls the pin out of the POMS grenade and it explodes, normally a bit behind, taking out the legs of anyone nearby. So those are mean, but again, you can survive it. If you're not moving too fast, you feel it. Step back, you haven't broken it yet. Step over it, perhaps, but it means you've got to watch where you're going. You want to watch where you're going all around, because you might get ambushed. You want to be alert to planes. I'm talking about Nuba Mountains during the war, but and Angola and Mozambique were like that at one time. But you've got to also be paying attention where you're putting your feet, so you don't put your foot on recently disturbed soil Why would that be disturbed? Somebody's planted a mine there. I mean, nobody's out there digging in paths normally. And so being alert to things like wires, metal, round objects. Never touch a mine or a suspicious explosive object. Only travel in high-risk areas when absolutely necessary. Try to avoid traveling after dark. Consult the local people concerning the location or known mines. When you've got friends or the people who discuss where the mines are, they'll, yes, it's on that side of the road, and it's right before this bridge and from that mountain over there. They normally know where the mines are. And so it's so important to know. But don't take their word for it. I've had it before where people said, our engineers have cleared everything on that side. The west side of that road safe. And shortly after that, I suppose there were some that the engineers missed. And that's the problem. That happens. I was in Angola, and you heard a just little, very soft, dull thud. And later, someone came in, he had lost his foot to a landmine. And I expressed my horror and disappointment, shame about this. And I said, no, no, it's okay. It was one of our mines. I don't know that that made it better, that he had accidentally stepped in one of their mines that they had for base protection. But you've got to be careful. Stay on well-worn paths and tracks whenever possible. And so when we're driving, we try to see, there's the tire tracks. We follow the tire tracks of the previous vehicle. Because why would I want to break new tracks in the soil when that vehicle's gone through and it's okay? If you see mangled cattle all over the place and up in trees, you know there's got to be a minefield around. Literally, that sort of thing happens. So when you see the edges of a road, fresh road repairs, very suspicious. More likely to put a mine there. So when you're walking, you want to walk in a single file path. Keep it the same path as the leader. And if possible, even putting your feet in where he's put his feet, you know, you see the footprints. And keeping a distance apart. This is where social distancing can actually save your life. Because in an area where there might be mines, you don't group together. You spread out. I mean, if someone's going to get injured, let's not have 5, 6 injured at one time. So if you enter a minefield, you want to backtrack the same way you entered. Now, these things have actually happened. Do you know there were more mines in Angola than people? They had well over 10 million mines in the country, more like 12 million. And they only had about 7 million people at the time, in the 80s. If you cannot retrace your steps, then prod your way out using a sharp knife, long blade, instrument held horizontally about 30 degrees to the ground, so you're feeling through the ground as you're crawling through to be sure that if there's any metal thing in front, you find it. You've got to repeat this procedure about 4 centimeters along the path and looking for any irregularities or hard objects. Battlefield areas like bunkers and barbed wire entanglements and ammunition dumps and helmets. Just seeing a helmet lying there. One shouldn't just go, oh, souvenir, pick up the helmet. That could be booby-trapped. They frequently will do that sort of thing. Destroyed vehicles, abandoned weapons may be mined. But where would you see animal remains or remains of footwear or something up in the trees that looks like it was a human being or an animal or a part of a foot in a shoe dangling from a tree nearby? That's signs of mines around, literally. And deserted buildings, abandoned vehicles could easily be mined as booby traps. So one has to be careful. Dirty yellow and green objects, metallic or plastic surfaces, could easily be mines. Many mines are made of plastic. But mines could also be round, they could be oblong, they could be rectangular, they could be made of metal. They can be made of plastic, and we've even come across mines made in wood boxes. Beware of wires, never pull wires. Where does this wire lead to? Pulling that, that's connected probably to some trip mine. Wooden stakes seen in conjunction with wire indicates a jumping jack. Be suspicious of any round edges that don't occur naturally in nature. So, these are just some of the sort of things that we've encountered in Mozambique and Angola.
Can
yes.
You clarify how the jumping jack works as far as what's the
path? Okay, so the jumping, there's two styles of the main jumping jack is you step on it and it arms. You step off it and that detonates and the first charge shoots the grenade up to about chest height, and the second charge explodes laterally with the shrapnel. Now that's the main jumping jack. The POMS mine is the stake linked by wire to either branch or tree or some stake elsewhere. So as you pull the wire, it literally pulls the pin out, and it's normally set to instantaneous, and that explodes laterally. But there is a wire type mine which is linked to you. Click through the wire as you go through it, arms are jumping jack, and it shoots up to chest height and then explodes. Now these are Soviet, Chinese, and Czechoslovakian grenades. These. So the jumping jacks, there's two varieties. The main one, you step on it, arm it, step off it, it explodes. But the other one is the wire, and it's attached to a stake. But in fact, it's going to shoot upwards. The first explosion shoots it up, and then second shoots it outwards. So
those would have been seen more in Mozambique?
I saw those a lot in Angola. We saw them less in Mozambique, but they were in Mozambique. It did happen. And in Sudan, a lot. The Sudanese National Islamic Front government used those a massive amount in the south and up in the Nubian Mountains. We had all sorts of mines and every kind. They tended to be, the ones in Sudan tend to be vehicle mines and personnel mines. I personally didn't come across the POMs and the jumping jack ones in Sudan, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were there. But we did come across them in Angola. And we did come across them in Mozambique. In fact, they were saturating Angola. Yes, the Cubans were there, the Russians were there, they were just using every kind of mines. So yeah, it was definitely a bigger problem in Angola, but Sudan overwhelmingly with vehicle mines.
You mentioned ways to avoid or to look out for mines on foot. Are there any ways in a vehicle to drive?
Yes. Right. So the first thing is, this again is why it's better to drive during day than during night, you've got better visibility and so on. And you've got to really watch the road. And in fact, the passenger should also be looking at the road. You need both eyes. Because also, you not only want to be looking at the road, you want to be knowing what's on the side too. So you've got to be maintaining. But if there's other tire tracks, you should be following those tire tracks as much as possible. Because that indicates if you come across a tire track and a big explosion, the vehicle's on the side, well, you know what happened there. But if you just see solid tire tracks, well, it's obviously clear. It's safe. If somehow you suddenly find it looks like fresh roadwork, somebody's dug, you can see some fresh soil from below, which is normally darker than the soil on top. And you can see when somebody's been disturbing the soil and they've planted something. To put something there that's displaced, so there's also a bit of extra soil around, or it's just slightly raised. It's very difficult to get exactly right and then to remove all the spare soil. So you'll still see darker soil on top. That's common because it's from underneath. You've been digging around. You had to remove soil to make space for this mine. So if you're going along, you should be able to see, that looks suspicious, and then you've got to avoid it. So again, if you're walking, as we'd normally take turns as point man in difficult areas, like Nuba, and the person in front, you'd want to try to follow his footsteps. Now again, if I'm going in sort of terrain like we were today in New Orleans Forest, you know that there's mines, they say. You would be preferring to step on rocks, solid rocks, than on soil, if you've got the choice. You'd really look carefully at where you're going to put your feet. If you're going through bush, you'd be alert for, are there wires? You'd be alert for something that you've got to... especially when you're going through and there's a lot of foliage. So the person in front, the point person, it takes a lot of intensity to be paying attention to absolutely every step and what's going on around. And that's why you've got to rotate regularly so that the person's fresh, taking points, being alert. But yes, in the vehicle, I think obviously you want to go a little bit slow in areas where you've got possibility of mines. You want to follow the tracks of the car in front. You want to look carefully, and if you've got any hesitation, you stop and check it out first. But the thing that has often caught people, and it should be something that we know better, is when you see something as strange as maybe A radio is just lying there. Or a helmet, you know, that's the thing. A person will normally go and pick that up. Well, it can easily be rigged. It can easily have a grenade balanced just underneath them. And they're just waiting for a person to do that. And that's a typical booby trap. You go into a house, and maybe there's a light bulb, and there's a string. And, oh, now this used to be an enemy territory. Now you've moved into it. Pulling that string could easily detonate a claymore mine, for example, directional mine. So when you're going into an area which the enemy has been forced to vacate, they're probably going to leave a whole lot of booby traps for the enemy coming in there. And there's several purposes for this. They want to discourage people coming. It's terrorism. Missionaries who've got to work in Burma, in the Buddhist military dictatorship of Burma, they face that kind of terrorism. And there's also mines that they'll put on the borders to discourage people trying to smuggle across aid to the Karen Christians who are suffering persecution. Other questions, comments? Yes.
You mentioned that when you're walking, you suspect that there are mines on the path that you're on, using a blade.
Yes.
If you feel something like click or do that, then would you take it out or just...
Well, you might want to, you've got to be careful, but you might want to just move the soil very, very carefully with your hands to see what it is. Now you can see, it's anti-vehicle, anti-personnel, or bombs, or whatever. So you've got the idea of what type of threat you're facing. Maybe all you found was a tin can that somebody abandoned after you had a meal there. So you want to know, is this a real threat or not? I wouldn't, as a person who's not an engineer, I would not even bother to try to take it out of something. But maybe just leaving it a little revealed so someone else knows now. Look, let's get a bit of a branch or stick it there to draw people's attention to the fact that there's something there. Now in the army we'd actually have little metal things with a little red flag on it and could stick there so the engineers following after could either remove or detonate from a distance or something like that. And just so others don't step on it. What we tend to do in Sudan is normally you bring some branches together. You stick something in to let people know. Like if you're coming along and you see some branches lying in the middle of the road, normally, you know, with green bushes on it, that indicates normally it's like a red triangle to inform you that there's a broken down car around the corner or something like that. But in Sudan, they'll often do that. They'll pull out some branches and throw it in the ground near where there's mines to warn you that there's mines there too. So you're not necessarily going to get a sign. But somebody's done something to indicate. And local people know the terminology. Like in Moreland in Equatoria, they were literally having branches of freshly broken tree branch that they just left there by the road, covering the rough area, which is so that you can't easily walk in it or drive in it to warn you. It would be nice if there's a sign saying mine, but you've just got to know that means there's mines there. If you don't see a broken down car just beyond. Because it could be evil. Again, the importance of communicating with your local hosts, the local churches, they will tell you what's going on. The chaplains will tell you. And of course, the ideal is, which we normally did in Sudan, we had a chaplain or a local pastor traveling with us. He knew what's going on. And when he gets to a place, he'd be asking ahead. And the people would know, yes, there's a lot of mines on this particular road. You've got to watch out for it. Oh, don't travel off dark on that road. There's ambushes. So the local people will normally be able to fill you in. Now, I can tell you what I did at the very beginning. Before I did any missions across the border, I regularly would go to the British ambassador go to the British embassy and ask for the military attaché. So, for example, before going into Sudan, I would go to Nairobi, to the British embassy and say, can I speak to the military attaché, please? Now, virtually nobody asked to see the military attaché. Military attaché is normally the spy. You know. He's there for military intelligence purposes. And so you ask to see the military attaché, he'll come down because, who's this? It's rare that he gets a request. Nobody's going to ask, why do you want to see him? And I'd go up to his office and he'd offer me tea and so on. And I'd say, I'm a British missionary. I'll do a British passport. I'd be a South African missionary, but got a British passport. So from his perspective, and I'm planning to go into Sudan. What can you tell me about the security situation? He'd say, well, here's the incident report. You pull up the maps, and there have been ambushes here, and there's bombings there. And I'm sort of looking at this map and making notes. And you know, he's happy to have a guest that breaks the boredom, being in a strange country. And normally we knew some of the people, and there's interesting sharing of. And it would always be a very pleasant experience. So I'd get a lot of details from the military attaché before I went in. He'd know what was happening where. Then he'd also say, you must be insane, and you know, advise no British subjects to go into Sudan. It's free fire zone, dangerous, and so on. But he'd give me advice. So that's helpful. My next stop would be the Red Cross Hospital in Kenya. And there's a lot of Sudanese in there. So we just read Bibles, we talk to people, so on. Then you stop, where did you lose your legs? And speak about the type of mines that they hit and where it was. You pay attention. And when, you know, who came out of Sudan most recently, and you find out from them, and they will tell you what's been going on there, where the bombings are and what tactics the Arabs use, and whether it's low-level flights, whether it's helicopters, whether it's high-flying antelope bombers, whether it's jets, bombers. And so we'd get to know what's going on. And so I've spoken to the ambassador, spoken to the military attaché at the embassy. I've spoken to people in the hospital who've come through. Now I'm looking for a refugee camp. Speak to people in a refugee camp, what's going on, they will tell you. Did the same in Swaziland before crossing into Mozambique. Mozambican refugees are threat to Angolan refugees are threat to Southwest Africa before going into Angola. And they will tell you what they know. And they're happy to. And then when you get to those places inside, you make yourself known to the local church and you ask how you can help. And they would then warn you, well, you must be careful not to go here and watch out about this. So foreknowledge is, forewarned is forearmed. It's so important to go with the best knowledge we've got. Our first step, if you plan to go to any country, let's just say Congo, first thing you do is you read Operation World's Trapped on the Congo. Then you find people from the Congo. Then you find missionaries who've traveled in the Congo. You get all the information you can, and then when you're at the border, maybe you're going to go in from Burundi. You speak to churches who've got contacts in Congo from Burundi, and when you cross the border, they'll put you in touch with local Christians. They'll guide you further. As much information as you can get, the better. We don't want to go in blind. So, any other questions or comments? Yes. 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 I would never go in blind. Well, the most blind I've ever had to go was into Angola. And we couldn't get much information about one particular area. And so made a hide. We called a hide. Sort of what you did today, making some kind of shelter. And nice and comfortable by the river, binoculars, and for 24 hours observed what's going on the other side. Saw when the patrols were, what's going on there, before swimming the river in. And so I knew what was going on from observation. I didn't know what was on the other side. And of course, on the other side, sure enough, once we swam the river, got the other side, came across minefield. Should have guessed that, but didn't know about it until got there, and so on. And so that was very hard, making first contacts into Angola. But once we got established, local churches, chaplains, you need to freedom fighters, then it got better and easier. But if you don't know and you've got to go in blind, the least you should do is spend 24 hours or more. I was very impatient. It should have been more like a week. But anyway, observing through binoculars what's going on, taking notes, taking turns with other teammates as to who's paying attention at any moment, and having exactly what's the movements on the other side, who the people on the other side, what they're carrying, saw the patrols and so on. But that, even that wasn't good enough. Sometimes you've got to do it, but you wouldn't just walk in. You would. So what we've done with our scenarios going to Newlands Forest is you've walked the terrain, you've seen the terrain, you know what it's going to be like. So when you go in the dark, you've got a better visualization of some of the paths and obstacles and potential trouble points that you're going to have. So you want to know everything you can about the area before you go in. So, anything else?
I just want to mention something, especially something like custom borders. If you want a smooth entry, it's a good idea to at least know the greeting of that country in the local language. Because I don't know what your experience is, but the moment you can greet the officials in their language, they're like, okay, you know what's going on, we can't just ask you for a bribe. And it just shows them a bit of confidence as well.
True. The more you know of the local language, the better, for sure. My first mission, I went in so blind, I didn't know much about anything. I didn't know a word of Portuguese. We didn't have a concept in the country. That wasn't ideal. But the Lord was merciful and gracious to us on that time, but thereafter he expected us to do better research and preparation. And so, yes, knowing some of the language, knowing some of the people, I mean, all that helps. If you've got letters of introduction or invitation, that helps too.
Two objectives in my sort of the one as you can piece the other.
Yes. That's always good. I would always have multiple goals and objectives and plan A, B, C, D, because often what you've planned for doesn't happen. Sometimes we've arrived at people who've even said they're gonna organize everything and you get there and you actually came. They haven't started doing any preparation. You know, you really want to have more than one back.